from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Pushing back on voter suppression efforts ahead of the 2020 election, challenging white supremacy, taking time for self-care. These are just a few of the issues occupying the mind of Bay Area civil rights leader Eva Patterson, whose career advocating for civil rights and social justice spans decades and extends back to her adolescence when in high school she traveled the state giving Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. On this MLK Day, we'll talk to her about her top priorities this year in the fight for equality. And that's all next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, Bay Area leader. Eva Patterson has been advocating for civil rights for over three decades, and she first entered the national spotlight as a 20-year-old college student when, at a time of turmoil in the United States, she debated Vice President Spiro Agnew on live television. A graduate of UC Berkeley's law school, Eva Patterson has served as director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, where she was part of a coalition that desegregated the San Francisco Fire Department. She co-founded and chaired the California Civil Rights Coalition and is currently president and co-founder of the Equal Justice Society. And welcome back, Eva.
So good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. It's been way too long. And I should note that you'll be speaking today in a personal capacity,
yes,
not on behalf of your organization, which we will talk about. But let's talk first about MLK Day. And, boy, you were, I'm certain, inspired at a very early age, as so many African-American young people were, by Martin Luther King, and particularly by the I Have a Dream speech, because I know you memorized the speech and gave it throughout the whole state of Illinois.
I was on the speech and debate team and went around the state giving the speech. And he was quite a person. I remember being in college the day he was assassinated, that Thursday evening on April 4th. And I was at Northwestern and everything burned to the ground in Chicago. It was startling that day.
And we were talking a little bit off air about the canonization of Martin Luther King. I remember talking to his biographer and there were, you know, things that really made him very human in many ways. How do you respond to the fact that, you know, on an MLK Day, he's almost kind of beatified?
Well, somebody kind of snarkily said on Twitter that we've turned Martin Luther King into Santa Claus. He's kind of this cuddly person, non-threatening. But if you read about what he did, and also he was assassinated by a white supremacist, but he was anti-war, and that got a lot of the black clergy enraged against him. He was for economic justice. All people now say, oh, I would have been with Dr. King. They probably would have hated him because he was very much against white supremacy and was for justice. So I think we need to remember the radical side of him. And also, I think we need to remember that he was a man of faith. He was a Christian minister, and he moved from a place of love, even though he was very much about changing things. And I remember how Trump kind of laughed at Nancy Pelosi, who said that she can't hate anybody because she's Catholic. And I was reminded of how Dr. King was. And I think that's something we need to think about as we deal with these horrible situations. We can't let the evilness of the other side corrode our souls. And so we need to remember that aspect of him as well.
Well, I remember the last time you were on the air with me, I believe, Charlottesville took place, and now we've got Richmond and all kinds of turmoil. Things have been somewhat more peaceful, and there's a great deal of anger against the governor for kind of quieting things down and putting the lid on them. But I remember after Charlottesville erupted, you were on the air, and President Trump gave a speech, and the speech was pretty much to your liking at the time. I mean, it was clearly not the speech that he was he wasn't tweeting. He wasn't talking off the cuff. It was written for him, probably. But he said things that were probably the right things to say after he had said things that angered a great number of people.
I think we were all – I think I remember being in your studio and his comments coming in. I'm going, wow, that sounds reasonable. But then he also said there are good people on both sides. So he had the wink and a nudge of giving the white supremacist his badge of approval. And they're out there marching today. People should take a careful look at these armed men with rifles. And I think they want to scare people who don't like Trump. But we can't be afraid. We have to stand up.
Stand up how?
We stand up in many ways. We have to stand up against white supremacy. It's very interesting. A friend of mine is Chuck Lawrence, who is a professor. He was at USF and then at Stanford. Now he's at Hawaii Law School. And I remember him about 10 years ago using the words white supremacy. And I went, oh, you can't say that. That's just too radical. And then we saw Trump gliding down the escalator, speaking evilly about Mexicans. So my organization started something called This Week in White Supremacy. Unfortunately, we're in our 105th week, and we just are pointing out to people all the different ways that white supremacy occurs. I also think that all people need to stand up and call it out, particularly white people. If they're in a situation with just other white people and they hear racist things happening, you need to call them out. Most importantly, though, is we have to make Trump a one-term president. We can talk about this more, but I think everybody in America who dislikes what they're seeing needs to get very involved in this campaign, going to other states, raising money, not being a circular firing squad, as the left often is. We don't have time anymore to fight each other and pick over specific policies. Policy is important. I listened to the guest in the last hour. He's exactly right. Trump represents evil, and imagine what he will do if he gets a second term. This is what he's done now with a check on him of possibly not getting reelected, but think of what he would do. So we've got to speak up. My organization, before the Democrats went ahead and called for impeachment, we called for the impeachment of Trump based on his racism. Putting Latino children in cages was the last straw for us. We'd kind of been, should we get involved in impeachment or not? And then our legal director, Mona Tawatow, found out that Andrew Johnson had been impeached on grounds of being racist. So at every opportunity, you have to get involved and be alert and be aware. Your people asked me what my priorities were, and one of the things I have to do is not be so rabid about this because there are other things in life, and we have to take care of ourselves. But this may be one of the most important years in the history of the United States. This is no joke. We've got to get this guy out of here.
Well, you heard the last hour. Rick Wilson was talking about this, like people talk about climate change, an existential threat. And Rick Wilson also was talking about the importance of getting black women behind a Democratic candidate, whomever that Democratic candidate might be.
Absolutely. My view is they need to make Stacey Abrams the vice presidential candidate because people will come out to vote for her. She's brilliant. But we as black women are the backbone of the Democratic Party. And as we go, so goes the fate of the Democratic Party. I've often felt, and this may be a provocative analysis, but I often feel that the Democratic Party treats black people as a battering husband treats his wife or a partner, in that we have no place to go. We have to just put up with it. And I was with some people a couple of days ago who said, I believe there was something like $30 million put into a particular state for voter outreach. 50,000 went for black people. That's insane. Because as your last guest said, if black people aren't voting for the Democrats, you're sunk. And if black women aren't voting for the Democrats are sunk. So you've got to pay attention to us. We've known Trump and his ilk were ridiculous for a long time. Listen to us.
So does this mean an endorsement for Joe Biden, who seems to have more black support than any of the other candidates? I mean, we've got Pete Buttigieg, I think I read recently, 2% of black voters are behind him. Even Amy Klobuchar, who's not much higher than that. They're the younger candidates. But then you've got Biden, who has a great deal of support, particularly in South Carolina, of black voters.
Here's the deal. Democrats have to get behind whoever is nominated. And we can't be, oh, I don't like his position on that, or he didn't shake her hand, and blah, blah, blah.
Can't be purists.
We not this election. I think Rick Wilson's exactly right. The fate of our country and indeed of the world is it hangs in the balance. So I am working for any Democrat who gets elected. I don't care. There are some I like more than others, but it doesn't matter at this point. And Democrats out there listening to me, we have to rally behind the candidate. This is no joke. And my problem I have with some Democrats is that, well, I'm going to sit out if so-and-so doesn't get elected. And I often feel that people with that position really have nothing to lose. It doesn't really matter to them on a day-to-day basis who gets elected. But if you're a Latino, you know it matters. If you're a Black person, you know it matters. If you're a woman who wants choice, you know it matters. If you care about the courts. So we, and I don't mean to be like your, you know, a negative aunt shaking my finger at you, but you can't sit home. You can't say I'm not voting. You can't say I'm voting for a third party. If you do that, you help Trump.
But what about when President Trump says, and, you know, you're talking from a Democratic point of view, and you talk about the analogy to an abused wife or an abused spouse with the Democratic Party, they take the Democrats, take Black people for granted as voters who will, which I think you could argue Hillary Clinton did with working class voters, too. Here's Donald Trump, who says, what do you got to lose?
Oh, my
you know,
God.
You haven't gained much by the Democrats and now have more Black people employed than you've ever had before.
Don't even get me started. I'm a lawyer. I care about the courts. The Supreme Court is what everybody focuses on. But the courts right below that, the courts of appeal, they adjudicate about 7,000 cases a year. And most cases don't go up to the Supreme Court. So the law is being made there. And Donald Trump has not appointed one Black person to the courts of appeal, not one. His head of HUD is now pushing policies that will allow more segregation in housing. Your zip code often defines your fate in society, where you go to school, access to education. So they are pushing back on this. You have an Attorney General Sessions who wanted to criminalize more things, reinstitute the death penalty. This has a disproportionate impact on Black people. If you are a Black person who cares about Latinos, you know that there are Latinos sitting in cages as we speak. A friend of mine was at the border in Tijuana a while ago, and she said not one African has been granted asylum. These are Africans fleeing death in Chad and other countries. Black Africans do not get into this country. I could spend the entire hour talking about what we have lost.
We'll have to have you for another hour maybe to do that. I want to talk actually with you about the repeal of it's a big effort to repeal 209. I want to talk here in California, but I also want to talk to you about voter suppression.
Yes,
because you mentioned Stacey Abrams before, and you know she's been a real lightning rod. And you, I know, recently went to Wisconsin. I mean, the facts are there. I mean, in Stacey Abrams' own race in Georgia, the facts are there in terms of voters who simply were suppressed from voting. And so, what needs to be done? What can be done, especially in those states that are going to be key?
My organization is putting together a voter empowerment conference right after the California primary. We want to send 2,020 people to the states around the country where voter suppression is most acute. One of my friends was in Georgia, and Black people got to a certain polling place, and the polling place was closed. So she had to go rent a van at the airport, picking up Black folks, taking them to the new voting place. So we're going to identify the specific ways that Black folks are and students and poor people are kept from voting. I understand that in Wisconsin, 100,000 Black people were kicked off the rolls in Milwaukee. Clinton lost by 20,000 votes. The same thing happened to Stacey Abrams in Georgia, where her opponent was the Secretary of State, who was just knocking Black folks off the rolls like crazy. And there's one little thing I wanted to share with you, if you can indulge me on this. Think about voter suppression in the year 2000. Remember Catherine Harris knocking off Black people in Florida, taking people off the rolls who were felons. And if you think about the consequences of the suppression of the Black vote, that gave the presidency to Bush. That then allowed him to appoint Roberts and Alito, which then allowed to Citizens United and the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. So the right wing knows very well that if Black people are allowed to vote, the power dynamics in this country change very dramatically. So we're all about fighting voter suppression. I heard Stacey Abrams speak in December. She's fabulous. And she has a group that she's organizing around the country to fight against voter suppression.
Well, let's turn to California, though, for a moment, because I know there's a big fight going on by the Equal Justice Society, which just celebrated its 25th anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To actually do something about California enrollment, and particularly in light of 209, because the reality is that 209 sort of works as a form of affirmative action, anti-affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are excluded. And let's talk about the campaign and what you hope to do in the repeal.
I hate to keep referring to Rick Wilson, but that was a fascinating interview. But he said something very interesting about climate. He said that isn't very high on the list of concerns of voters. Similarly, in 1992, after I'm an old professor, so just bear with me.
We share that.
In 1992, Clinton won the White House. In 1993, Patrick Buchanan, who you and I will remember but others may not, he wrote for Nixon, very right-wing cat, wrote this column in the Examiner, which I don't know if it exists anymore.
But it does. Yeah.
But he basically said, if the Republicans are to regain the White House in 1996, they need to put something on the ballot to engage the angry white men, which became the Tea Party, which became MAGA. And so they put affirmative action on the ballot. What they did is they made it impossible for any institutions to admit kids based on racial considerations, not quotas, to do employment. And then the money behind it was actually behind the from the Associated General Contractors. So there was no affirmative action in education, in employment, and in the award of contracts. Over the past 24 years, businesses owned by people of color and women have lost $1 billion a year because municipalities may not take race or gender into awarding contracts. The municipalities never had quotas, but they were able to say, if you're a contractor, you need to have some people of color or women-owned businesses as your subcontractors. So we lost the election, and I have to take responsibility for that. We were really stupid at that time because we said, basically, if you're against affirmative action, you're aligned with the Ku Klux Klan, which made us feel good, but it didn't get to the persuadables, people who might have liked our point of view. So every few years, we have been doing polling to see if the demographics are ripe for repealing 209. And this summer, the polling indicated that we can do this. So there are discussions in the legislature about putting this on the ballot without having to go through the signature gathering campaign. And so we have a whole campaign that's ready to get up and run. And we hope to have this on the ballot in November of 2020. And I hope we have the biggest party that you can imagine, with Trump going back to Mar-a-Lago for good on his own dime, and with 209 being repealed.
Can you talk about the figures, though, the billion-dollar figure?
Yes.
and where that is, or how that's computed? Because there also, I've seen some figures about $30 million of losses in contracts in both Oakland and really in the biggest cities here in Northern California, San Francisco and Oakland.
We got a grant from the Cerdna Foundation to do research on how much money has been lost. And the $1 billion a year is actually low because we were not able to capture all the information. If there's no consideration of gender, and this impacts women-owned businesses as well as businesses owned by people of color, but if there's no ability to kind of go out and bring them in, then there's no way that people can get these contracts. So that's really very, very disturbing.
And what are we talking about with respect to getting rid of 209? I mean, it also seems to indicate that there's not an allowance or a kind of permission to talk freely in ways that need to be discussed and talked about.
Well, one of the interesting dynamics, and I'm a Kumbaya Rainbow Coalition person, is that there are some members of the Asian Pacific Islander community who think that affirmative action has kept qualified Asian American students out of UCs. The actuality is that it has not adversely impacted Asian Pacific Islander students getting into UC Berkeley. And so we have these very difficult conversations where we're trying to stay respectful of each other's communities while we're also saying everybody benefits, and white people too. If there's more money in the pockets of businesses owned by people of color and women, we hire our own folks, it will improve everything in the society. But we're trying to have these conversations and not have the circular firing squad.
Well, we're old enough to remember Richard Nixon talking about black capitalism.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
We're talking, by the way, with Eva Patterson. She's here with us in Studio Bay Area, civil rights leader, veteran fighter of many causes, and warrior in civil rights. Also now got a big battle going on with litigation against schools that suspend and expel kids of color, especially, kids who are often, shall we say, have problems and disabilities or other kinds of problems. Where do you see the battle going there?
I always feel like I'm giving lectures, but one of the things that we wanted to do at the Equal Justice Society was to change some law around the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In order to win, you have to show that any discrimination was intentional. Now, you have Donald Trump saying he loves black people, he's our best friend. Even people like him think they're not discriminatory and they don't think they're racist. So Michelle Alexander, who wrote the book The New Jim Crow, talked at our first conference in 2003 at Stanford. And she talked about a concept that was very new at that time called implicit bias. And you look at people's brains and you have in your conscious mind what you want to do. I don't want to eat cake because I'd like to lose weight. Then there's cake. You eat the cake because there's some unconscious part of you that just does that. There are all kinds of studies that show that if you show a black man holding a phone and you have a simulation with people with guns, they will shoot the black man more rapidly than they will shoot a white man holding a phone because they'll assume the phone in the white black man's hand is a gun. And so there are all these stereotypes that get us to act in very racist ways, even though we don't want to be racist. So one thing we found is that I believe most teachers in California do not want to discriminate against kids but of color. But if you look at the data, kids of color are disproportionately suspended and expelled, and kids of color with disabilities are often disproportionately suspended and expelled. I have a white friend whose kid goes to school in Orinda, and she says, my kid acts out in class because he has disabilities. If he were black, he'd be suspended. But in Orinda, they go, oh, let's talk to you. Let's see what we can do to help. So in Bakersfield and in Sacramento and in Antioch, we have found situations where kids of color are disproportionately suspended and expelled. So what we're trying to do, rather than call the administrators and the teachers racist, we're saying implicit bias plays a role here. And they understand that because you're giving them the benefit of the doubt. And this is in the early stages.
Implicit bias sounds a lot better than racist, too, doesn't it?
There you go. There you go. And so we are working out ways for people to minimize their implicit bias. For example, if you have to write down why you're expelling Jamal but not Jimmy, you might have to stop and think, oh, wait, Jimmy did exactly the same thing that Jamal did. Why am I expelling Jamal? So we're doing all kinds of new things to figure out how we can minimize the impact of implicit bias. The social science is rather new on this, and so we don't know what works long term, but we have sued these schools or have been involved in negotiations with these school districts because they want to do the right thing. Teachers want to make sure kids are trained, kids are schooled.
All right, let me give out a phone number and invite those of you listening to join us with Eva Patterson. If you have something you'd like to say or ask, you can be part of the program, and you can do that by giving us a call now. Number to call, 866-733-6786. Let me say that again, 866-733-6786. Or you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Spending the hour with civil rights leader Eva Patterson, talking about fighting for equality in 2020, and also talking about Martin Luther King and whatever else is on your mind related to the conversation we're having. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are spending the hour with Bay Area civil rights leader Eva Patterson. And let me go right to your calls. Let me begin with Cheryl. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Eva, thank you for your wonderful work, both of you. I'm a retired nurse, and I have time but not a lot of money. I would love to be able to help with registering voters anywhere in the country. And I wonder how I could be a part of your program.
If you go to our website, equaljusticesociety.org, this is nonpartisan, and this is going to be, we're organizing people to go to these states where voter suppression is a problem. But go to our website, equaljusticesociety.org, and just leave your name and your email address, and we'll get back in touch with you. We're trying to get Stacey Abrams to come out here and speak. We haven't heard back from her people, but we already have SEIU as a co-sponsor, the California Civil Rights Coalition, the New Georgia Project. We have a woman coming out to speak at the panel then. So if you just go to our website, leave your name and information, and we'll get back a hold of you.
And thank you for that question, Cheryl. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from some more listeners in just a moment. I'm just wondering, though, you say nonpartisan, but for the most part, the attempt has been to do something about voter suppression in light of the fact that most of those who are suppressed do vote Democratic. I mean, I think there's a pretty easy case to make there. What are your feelings about the fact that you mentioned no white judges named by Trump, for example, in the judiciary, especially at the top federal levels? What do you think about the fact that we're seeing all white candidates now in Democratic debates?
I find it very disturbing. My candidate was Kamala Harris because I've known her for so long, and I was so sad when she wasn't able to continue. I think there's a more profound question that needs to be addressed once we get rid of Trump, and that is campaign finance. Because as long as you have somebody like a Steyer, who's a great guy, Bloomberg, who I don't know, but I feel like I do because he's in my TV every 2 seconds, but as long as you have cats like that who have so much money and can just buy their way onto the stage, America is not getting its best people. So my view is we need to have full public financing of all elections so that the best people can rise to the top. Because I think if money were not an issue, I think you'd have very different people on the stage. And so I think it's very disturbing that I think Andrew Yang is still there. So there is a person of color involved. But it's very disturbing, particularly certainly.
He didn't make the last debate.
Oh, he didn't. Oh, no. He didn't. Okay.
I mean, I think he's still in the race, but Cory Booker is out now, for example.
Yes.
Let me go to another caller. That's you, Thomas. Join us. You're on the air.
Yes. This is a question for Ms. Patterson, although it was something I would have loved to have asked your previous guest, Mr. Wilson. Unless Donald Trump is defeated in a landslide, how are you really going to get him out of office when the likely scenario is going to be he's going to allege massive fraud? He's going to egg his supporters through tweets to take all the measures possible to keep him in office. And when you realize that a lot of these people are very fervent Second Amendment supporters who have arsenals in their homes, I mean, it seems to me, unless Donald Trump is defeated in the landslide, we may be facing a civil war in this country by the end of the year.
There is that argument. And your thoughts, Leva?
I've got several comments. I often draw back on my ancestors when I'm starting to feel like things are just too difficult. And I know there was a time when people said slavery will never end, even if the folks are emancipated, things are going to be awful. And there still are racists, but my people are not enslaved. Second thing, somebody says, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? We just need to take this a step at a time. We need to rally behind whatever Democrat gets elected and put down any petty differences we have. And then the final thing is, let's defeat him by a landslide. A lot of black folks didn't vote. We're coming out to vote. We are going to vote for this cat. They asked what percentage of black people think Trump is racist. It's like 84%. I mean, I don't know.
Is that percentage of Republicans who think that Trump should be the candidate and is the candidate?
I think that's right. But we will come out to vote. So let's not buy trouble yet. And they're trying to scare us today with this armed rally in Virginia. Let's beat him in a landslide. We can do that. Don't freak out by what might happen. As Scoop Nisker used to say, and Mike and I are probably old enough to remember him on KSAN, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. So let's just do this thing. Take it one step at a time.
Related question from a listener named Jay, who says, I believe that Trump is the voice of fear and hatred of a certain percentage of the country. I don't think he generated that fear and hatred. I think he's just exposed what was already there and made it acceptable. Assuming that's true, how can we change attitudes that were already there before Trump? How can we prevent another Trump from coming along?
I think you're exactly right. And I sometimes will just weep when I go, how could 40% of the country be behind this guy? And this is kind of trivial, but he tweeted out this picture saying it's snowing in D.C. and it wasn't. And people still vote for him. I just don't understand it. I must say that when we have done implicit bias work with people, kind of exposing them to the fact that they do act in biased ways, even though they in their conscious minds don't think they're biased, people start acting differently. So I think there are some people in the middle we can bring over to our side. I also think it used to be bad to be racist, and Trump made it okay again. And so I think you have this enabler in chief making people feel like it's okay to be racist. And then there are the people who are just lost causes, who are never going to do anything right. We celebrated or commemorated, if you will, the 400th anniversary of enslaved Africans arriving in this country. And one of the things that my friend, Professor Shauna Marshall, pointed out at a conference at the Federal Building was that the only way evil white people could enslave, rape, beat, and sell us was to think that we were inferior. And so there's still that element in the country that feels I'm poor, but I'm not black. And then you had this magnificent black family in the White House, and people are going, wait a minute, if a black person's president, that must mean there's something wrong with me. And I think Trump fed right into that sense of inferiority that people had around the Obamas. So I think there's some people we can bring over to the good side, and then there's some people who are just lost.
Nelson wants to know, how does affirmative action promote equality?
It deals with the underrepresentation of people of color and women in particular industries. For example, we had hearings at the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. There was this incredibly well-qualified Asian-American architect who's gone on to design beautiful things. She said when she went for her interviews, she could tell that the men interviewing her just did not take her seriously at all. And so she was not given the contract. I think about what I just said about implicit bias, that people think that we are intellectually inferior. There's a study called Are Jamal and Lakeisha as Employable as Emily and Brandon? You have similar exact resumes, and the resumes that have white-sounding names get hired more, get more interviews than the resumes with black-sounding names.
Of course, that study was done a number of years ago. There's the other counter-argument you hear now, that companies are much more aware of diversity, that the diversity campaign has made them more aware.
There's a more recent study that was done in a law firm where they had the exact same legal memo that was written. This was done in the last 3 years. And they told half of the associates or people making the judgment that the person who wrote it was black. They told the other half the person who wrote it was white. The people who thought the writer was a white person, this person is fabulous. This is brilliant. They even found fewer grammatical errors in the memo that was written by, they thought was written by a white person. The black person, how did he get out of law school? He's just terrible. So they're unconscious views about the intellectual abilities of people of color and women that impact hiring. And these are things that people are not conscious of. So if you have a contracting system in California where 97% of the contracts go to white men, and some of my best friends are white men, so I'm not trashing them, there's something wrong. So there's inequality that's still built into our system, and taking race into account levels the playing field. I got into Berkeley Law School on affirmative action. I passed the bar the first time. I've done very well as a lawyer. I'm qualified. And I think I'm a good example of why affirmative action is good.
Our guest again, Eva Patterson, Bay Area civil rights leader, and our next caller, Raul. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. I'm really enjoying this. I'm not enjoying it, but I'm really happy you're doing it. I met Eva about probably 20 years ago at a KQED event where I think when it was a discussion group on stage. It might have been your 10th anniversary. But in any case, I want to call attention to Michelle Alexander's column in the New York Times Sunday Review. And in it, she pretty much defines the issue for black people and for white people as far as racism and unconscious bias in our society that's at the root of a lot of things that we're talking about. So I highly recommend people look that up and read it, and I'm glad you're having this conversation.
Well, thank you for that call, Raul, and let me sort of second that. I'm familiar with Michelle Alexander's work, and I think it's very important. She's a professor at Ohio State University and has done what I would call seminal work, really, in the bias that exists toward incarcerating people who happen to be black. Here's a listener who writes, in a new Washington Post Ipsos poll, 92% of the black Americans polled said they have not experienced a circumstance where they attempted to vote but were not allowed to in the past decade. Eva, what do you say?
8% is a huge number of people. You had 100,000 people or so black
1%
votes.
Gave no opinion. 7% said they had.
Okay. But you have demonstrably that black people were kicked off the rolls in Georgia and in Wisconsin. 7% is a lot of folks. And so that's the balance. I mean, think about that in Wisconsin. Clinton lost by 20,000 votes.
Over 2,000 people we're talking, over about 20,000 people, yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's Olivia who tweets, how do you feel about the minor spat that Senator Warren seemed to insist on having with Senator Sanders? It felt silly and unnecessary in my opinion. Also, what could get young people off their butts and to the polls?
I think all Democrats have just got to unite. My friend Susan Baranoff said, this isn't about any particular candidate. It's about all of us. And all of us must unite to get this horrible man out of the White House. And so I'm not going to weigh in on that. I just hope that supporters on for Warren or for Bernie come out and vote no matter what. I also have been kind of heartbroken by the fact that very young people in their 20s have a feeling that the planet may not survive, that it may blow up and just burn to the ground. You and I are of an age, Michael, where I think the Earth will be around until we're gone. But the fact that young people think that climate change and the degradation of our planet is truly an existential crisis, I think that will motivate young people to come out and vote. Rick Wilson said no. I don't know. But I think if you look at what Trump is all about in terms of the climate, you need to come out and vote. Now, some people aren't going to vote, but I think those of you out there on listening, there are people in your world who aren't going to vote. This is what I'm asking of you. Reach out to them and tell them the fate of our country is at stake. I remember when I entered Northwestern in 67, my father had just come back from the war. I supported the war. I actually said to the people from McCarthy, we have to support the war because the president's for it, and whatever the president says, we have to do. Ha ha. Within a year, I'm, picketing, blockading highways and the like. But that's because I listen to people. I listen to leaders. So there are people in your universe who you can impact. Ask, don't be a bore, because sometimes I can be just a pain. I'm always talking about politics. But maybe as part of a casual conversation, you can find out if your friends are voting and explain to them why it's important.
And a tweet from Tina who says, the example of implicit bias I love is how the diversity of symphony orchestras improved dramatically when musicians started auditioning behind a screen so decision makers couldn't see them. That's, again, one of those classic studies.
And they augmented it by having the shoes covered because men walked differently than women. And when they did that, the numbers of women in orchestras went up. And if you had asked those men making the decisions, are you biased against women? They'd say, absolutely not. And they would believe it. But their unconscious feelings about women musicians impacted their decision making.
And we go to another one of your calls. Let me go next to Don, who joins us from San Francisco. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I really appreciate your work that you're doing, and I really, really support it and actually want to get involved
going
to your website and really support it because, it's everything that you said. I'm a black man, I'm educated, have an MBA, and I ended up having to start businesses because I couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually happened to be in construction area working in sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a report that came out a couple years ago with the development over in Candlestick and so forth and so on. For people that have my type of business, we got like 1.2%.
There you go.
And that's just a shame. It's a shame. Some of our solutions are far beyond what people are doing. And I actually was in, I will bring this up and leave it at that. I was actually in a hotel council meeting, and this is how the bias, how implicit it is. Anyway, a woman told me that another woman said to her, who let Tupac in here?
Oh, sorry. Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, I experience this all the time. Anytime I open my mouth, I had a judge ask me who helped write my motion, my opposition to the motion. Because I don't have enough intelligence to do that.
When I was a baby lawyer in the federal court, the lawyers would sit in the jury box, and a bailiff came over to me once and said, "You're not allowed to sit there. This is only for the lawyers." And you're just going, please. If you read Bryan Stevenson's book, and his movie is coming out, Just Mercy, soon, he says he's often mistaken for a defendant. So this goes on all the time. And we thought we were post-racial with Obama, which is ludicrous. But that's why you need affirmative action. So people have to take race and gender into account when they're giving out contracts or employing people or admitting people to universities.
What about racial bias training? I mean, there's certainly a lot of that, and some of it is looked on favorably, some of it is looked on as a pain, you know, and all that. Can you retrain people to not only be conscious of their bias — I'm talking more about white people here — mm-hmm. but also to do something about it?
It's very tricky, Michael, because it's been shown that diversity training actually makes people more racist and more biased.
Yeah,
because they're
I've
irritated.
Seen those studies, yeah.
They're very irritated. So what we're trying to do, and this is why I said earlier —
most people don't think they're racist to begin with.
No. But this is what I said earlier, saying that the social science is new. There's a woman named Patricia Devine at the University of Wisconsin, and she's been able to get people to mitigate their implicit bias, but it only lasts for 7 months, and then it goes back up. So one thing we've been talking about is people need to keep statistics on who they're hiring, on who they're disciplining, and come up with very kind of concrete, empirical ways of determining who's qualified and who isn't. But this is a concept that's still being evolved. Kaiser is having a conference on this in March to figure out how you mitigate it. And we're going to have a conference, a small conference, in the summer.
Kaiser Foundation, mm-hmm. you mean, as opposed to Kaiser Permanente?
I think, one of the Kaisers.
One of the Kaisers. Yeah. And we don't mean the German Kaiser, obviously.
No.
Note of levity in there. What about California Justice Society? You got about a $200,000 grant, I believe, just a year ago. And are you doing stuff with racial bias on that?
We got a $200,000 grant from the Ford Foundation, which has been supporting us for a long time. We have fabulous supporters. The California Endowment gives us money, Akinati Foundation, Open Society. So we are funded by George Soros. So the rumors are true. He is funding people like us. So, and we also have wonderful individual supporters. And then we believe that art is a very important part of the social transformation.
And, so, you know, as soon as people hear the name Soros, they think you're trying to create the invasion of Latinos and Latinas into the United States. I mean, he's been charged with that, and especially on white supremacy type of websites.
Well, that's why I explicitly mentioned his name, because he's been trashed and he shouldn't be. He's given a lot of money to make things better.
There's Nick, who tweets, "While African-Americans struggle to be heard in their own nation, the world needs to hear their voices. I hope more African-Americans would consider involvement on the national and local stages of politics. God bless and love to you on this good day." Nice sentiments, Nick. Thank you for those.
Thank you so much.
And we'll get another caller on, and that's Bob. Bob, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking the call. I just wanted to make a short comment and a question, I guess, about the notion of public financing. One of the reasons why this is so difficult and the issues of financing are so difficult, it's because it's so damn expensive to run because of all of the costs, because of the broadcast costs, because of now the internet ad costs and so on. In Australia, where they have mandatory voting, there's a slight behavioral nudge. You have a fine of about $15, and basically everybody comes out and registers and everybody comes out and votes. Now, that doesn't address the suppression issue, which is a terrible issue all of its own. But the fact is that we could have a much less expensive process inherently by simply making sure that everybody has to vote.
Mandatory voting. Eva Patterson?
I think it's a great idea. Also, there are some countries that have like 6-week campaigns. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, nothing against Mr. Bloomberg, but I'm tired of his ads. And I also think that it's a circular situation. Everything's expensive because there's lots of money, and then there's lots of money because everything's expensive. And so people buy big TV buys, and then that's expensive, so people raise money. I think we could really profoundly change how elections are done. The problem is the people who have to do it generally are the incumbents. And I remember when Obama ran, we thought he was going to take public financing, and he didn't. He took money from all kinds of people, which is understandable. But I think we have to start having the discussion. How this started with me is that Gray Davis was asked to sign a piece of legislation that would have required, this is a long time ago, that would have required police officers to keep racial data. He didn't sign it. And one of his top aides, when I asked him why, he said, well, you all didn't give him money. And it was like, what? So it's not just the... It's we've got to make.
Well, the reason he lost his governorship was too much money tied to even getting in the door.
Indeed.
Ray Davis was governor. Let me thank Bob for the call, and we'll go next to you. Joel, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to thank the guest, you know, for all the work she's done, all the awareness. And also, I just want to say, you know, that I feel like affirmative action is just one stepping stone. We have to keep pushing it forward, bring up new laws that are current to our time, and think of, you know, everybody that fought in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, what they were doing, the failure of Reconstruction,
mm-hmm.
and it's up to us to carry that forward and move it, keep moving it. So
absolutely.
All right, Joel, we thank you for those sentiments, and we go right to another call. It's Aaron, who's joining us from Woodlands, California. Aaron, hi, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing that I hear people say is they're in favor of equal opportunity, not equal achievement. And that's an argument against affirmative action. And my reply to them is often, if I have the presence of mind to make it, that do they believe that there is equal opportunity, to which they reply yes. And then do they believe that there is equal achievement, to which they reply no, because they're not necessarily completely divorced from reality. And then I say, well, how do you explain that? And it puts them in this position of having to say outright the thing that they don't want to say outright, which is that they just don't think women or blacks or whatever it is can achieve as much. And they come up with some explanation, well, blah, 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 they, you know, women get pregnant, whatever it is. And I, but it doesn't work. And this is my question to you. Nothing seems to work. You can't logic these people into accepting that they've just made a mistake, which is something everybody does. Everybody makes mistakes. But you just can't seem to actually logic them into it. How do we get through to these 40% of Americans who are destroying us? How do we do it?
I like your use of logicking as a verb, or gerund, I guess. I mean, Aaron's raising an important point here. How can you change minds when they are so cemented and solidified?
Here's what's fascinating. Trump has done something good for us. About 52% of white Americans now believe in affirmative action, because I think people had this view, oh, Oprah's rich, the president's black, everything's cool. And now they're saying, oh, hell no. I don't know if I'm allowed to say hell, sorry. But people are seeing that there's bigotry. Also, for the repeal of 209, we just have to get 51%, and we think we can do that. And so we've got to turn people out to vote. And then here's something. There's a professor at one of the universities in New York named Andrew Hacker, and this is kind of a little evil thing, but I think this kind of tells the tale. He asked his class, he said, if you were going to ask the white people, if you knew you were going to become black at midnight and you were never going to be able to be white again, how much money would you want? Now, if we're on the level playing people, people go, money? I don't need money. My life would be different. So they're going like 10 million, 5 million, 3 million. So people know that if you're black, you catch a lot of hell in this country, if they're being honest. So I think we're not going to get everybody. There are persuadables in the middle that we can pull over. Remember, America elected a black president. I wept like a baby that night. I never thought I'd see a black president. So there are people making changes. I understand that younger people are less biased than my generation, and there's more biracial kids. So I'm hopeful. I'm an eternal optimist. We just keep plugging away, one bite at a time of the elephant.
What does your optimism tell you on this MLK Day about the legacy of Dr. King, or what perhaps he has left upon the Republic? And what he should indeed be honored for?
Well, this day, I probably wouldn't be here except that it's Martin Luther King Day. I hope I can come back. But this is a day about race. And it's a
You've
day
been
about,
on other days.
It's true. It's true. And it's a day that I can talk about being black. As I said before, I'm a Kumbaya Rainbow Coalition person, but I'm also black. And I get to talk from that perspective today. Also, you have Governor Pence. He's the vice president, getting up and saying, Martin Luther King influenced me greatly. I'm sure that is a lie, but he has to get up and pretend that he is all about what Dr. King was about. If you are on Twitter or social media or read anything about what Dr. King was about, he was a very militant man who was assassinated. One of the ironies of this whole period of Comey and the FBI is me defending the FBI when they were horrible back in the day. They sent King letters trying to get him to kill himself. And so the government was attacking him. So I think it's a day that's if people are not just having an extra ski day or, you know, a white sale at Macy's, but it's a day for people to think about race and about struggle. And he was in prison for what he did. He was vilified. There was racism. He was for economic development. He was anti-war. So if people really focus on who he was, it's an opportunity for us to expand our vision and to get out there and do something.
And you remember there was a time when people were fighting even about setting this day aside to
there
honor
you go.
Martin Luther King.
There you go.
Eva, always good to see you. Thank you so much
a
for
pleasure.
Joining us. Eva Patterson, Kumbaya and all the rest. Bay Area civil rights leader for many years. And we are here with you for many years, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, the Forum Program. Hope you will continue this discussion. In fact, invite you to do that online, going to kqed.org/forum. Tomorrow will be preempted because impeachment trial begins. We'll talk about it, certainly, afterward, and many other things as we do day to day. Stay with us on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.